You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 1st of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias.
And coming up on today's programme, we'll be reviewing a festival that celebrates the art of cinematography and some new releases from our favourite film critic, Karen Krasanovich.
I was sitting in this coffee house and this old man at the table next to me struck up a conversation.
He said you had an amazing story.
Let's see then, where to begin?
Also ahead, our guest music reviewers, no regular player waiting in the wings to talk us through the New York DJ scene.
And we'll be settling down for a night in front of the Gogglebox with our personal TV guide, Lisa Campbell.
So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
And a very warm welcome to Studio One here at a very festive Midori House because it is our Christmas market.
It is incredible out there, Gillian. Just to describe the atmosphere, not in this studio because we're itching to get out, but we will bring you the best review that we possibly can in the circumstances, ladies and gentlemen. There are dozens of people coming through the gates to see our reindeer, to have a slice of raclette, to see Nancy Durham's lavender store.
Glittering white Christmas lights.
Father Christmas is here.
I know.
He's come in. And lots of other nice faces from Midori House are around. I've just seen regular presenter Ted Kravitz. He's brought his little girl in. All the Midori House regulars and faces are around today to give you a very warm welcome. It is tremendous fun out there.
Exactly. And we're going to concentrate on our programme, but also if any listeners are intrigued and want to pop by it Saturday, Sunday, come by One Dorset Street.
It would be lovely to see you all. We've both had very different cultural weeks, though, in terms of where you've been and what I've seen.
I know.
What have you been up to?
Well, I just came back from Doha, where I was making a film on the Doha Film Festival. And, you know, it's somewhere maybe I wouldn't normally go to on the film festival circuit, but at this moment in time when so much is happening in the Arab world, it's a great place to clock and listen to that emerging cinema of change that's starting to come out after the revolution.
Is there a feeling of independence and a fresh voice that's being given to the region?
You know, what's interesting. It's not blindly optimistic. People know that there's still going to be censorship and there's still going to be problems. But I think what they feel now is they have stories to tell. They have really interesting stories to tell. And that is just motivating them as much as anything else. And there's this community spirit where they're really all helping each other and they're doing things for free. And my film went up yesterday and I encourage people to watch it because it really gives a sense of that that energy that's in the region.
Let's have a little bit of a listen.
This year was a beautiful year of production. I think we had a lot of projects to choose from. So that shows that people have more access for different reasons. I think first it's the digital age. So more people are able to make films on their own, which is great. And the other one, of course, is for the changes, social and political changes.
Well, that was a clip of Gillian DeBias' film on the Doha Film Festival, which is up on the Monocle website at the moment. We're joined in the studio. We're supposed to be coming to you in a little while. Karen Krasanovich, our regular and, of course, most favourite of film reviewers. But you were listening very closely to that, weren't you?
Yeah, I was.
She snuck into the studio a little early, but it's a perfect time because you, of all people, it's great to talk film festivals.
I was thinking, if I was home, I'd be thinking, how do I find this clip? How do we find the clip?
Well, all my films are on their own page, but A, B, C, D, E, and you just, if you want a fairs film, you click A. If you want business films, you click B.
What site are we talking?
And this is monocle.com.
Monocle site,
so
okay.
All Monocle. And this is the film festival, so this is under C for Culture, and just went up yesterday.
Gillian's films are quite something. What was it like going to a film festival in Doha?
Well, I mean, the Arab region or the Emirates and sort of whether it's Dubai or Abu Dhabi, they all kind of are competing now to have the most glamorous film festival and bring in the biggest stars and have the most glamorous red carpet. And I think what was interesting this year is Doha sort of pulled away from that and thought, you know what, we're not going to pretend to be Cannes or we're not going to pretend to be Venice. let's just focus on the MENA region mostly. Mm-hmm. It's the Tribeca Film Festival, so there was De Niro there, and they did have international stars. But I think they wanted it smaller and relevant to the region, relevant to Qatar. Mm-hmm. It's also part of a bigger film institute that funds local cinema. And it's a very young filmmaking nation.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of money in Doha. I mean, Western filmmakers are turning to Doha and to Abu Dhabi and that region looking for funding. Mm. And Doha is one of the ones that's supposed to have the most, but they're very, very selective about, you know, where they're sending the funding. But I think it's interesting that Doha this year is influenced by the Arab Spring and really, really moving away from that kind of the business side of things, although that's always there because the films can't exist without it, but more to the stories of the people. So I think it's quite interesting.
And also, though, I think the business side, in a way, is important in the sense that they do have the wealth, but they want to use it well. So the Reluctant Fundamentalist premiered there, and that was co-financed by the Doha Film Institute. Mm-hmm. So they choose their stories, and they have to be relevant.
Very much so. I think people have a tendency to think, oh, China, there's a lot of money. They'll just give it to us, or Doha, they'll just give it. No. They are going to be very, very selective, which is good. But I think it is very exciting, and I'm looking forward to seeing your films.
What are the criteria for the selection in terms of what you think people will back and won't back? Because I know that the Qatar Foundation is very selective in terms of what it backs in broadcast terms especially. But in terms of cinema, do they think they have a particular subject matter or a direction that they want to promote?
I mean, it'd be interesting to hear what you've got to say, but from what I understand is I've had several friends go over with scripts and development and projects and packages that they're looking for something that has an Arab voice, has an Eastern voice, but also something that will appeal wider. To global. It's great.
I think one of the first films they financed was, I think it was called Black Gold, which was all about the finding of the gold. And that was a big production budget. It was meant to be something of international interest. I don't think it was critically acclaimed. I don't think it was a success.
I think it's quite difficult because the style of filmmaking there is not a global style, if that makes any sense at all. And also, I think there have been several attempts to try and film the unfilmable, which is to represent religious figures, which I think can be problematic as well.
It can be dangerous. Let's move on to another film festival, which has been running this week, but somewhere distinctly colder. Karen, tell us more about this.
Bidigosh. In Bidigosh, yes, I want to get that out because I've been practicing it all morning. The Blue Camera Image, or Plus Camera Image, if you're American, started about 20 years ago. And it is actually one of the best film festivals. And you never really hear people talking about it.
I'm so glad you brought this up. I've been always wanting to go. And it's the unsung heroes of cinematography.
It is. It's not, and not only cinematography, and I was quite surprised, it's also editors and everybody else around the filmmaking. It's the important people who keep a low profile who get things done. And I think that that's really, really interesting.
So why choose Poland as a location for a film festival like this? Is it the heritage behind it? Is it the fact that cinematography, one automatically associates it with perhaps a European feeling? Maybe I'm wrong there. But when you think of Polish cinema, you think of Krzysztof Kieślowski, who just does cinematography like you've never seen cinematography. Why Poland?
If you'd stopped earlier, I would have said yes. It's such a nifty little thing there. Because there is an enormous visual history there. There's an enormous, they make amazing posters as well and the graphic arts. But some of the greatest cinematographers come from Poland. And the wonderful thing is that they embrace, the Poles just love cinematography. They love beautiful. I mean, they don't care who you are, you know?
Great. They're the poets of cinema.
Exactly. They are visual poets. Yeah. You're good.
Well, I've That's always wanted, you know, the filmmaker in me has just longed to go to this festival.
You should go. They would love you. You could go and have a lot of fun. Also, I love the fact that, you know, on a small scale that they give out golden, silver, and bronze frogs, which I think is quite nice.
Destination in
it's not stallions or anything. You know, it's a frog, is quite good.
The other thing I was interested in, you were talking about Keanu Reeves has done a very interesting documentary. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yes, it's called Side by Side. And Keanu's been very, I saw him in Parenthood just a couple of days ago. And he's so cute with his fringe. But he's grown up now and he's producing. He's not only making a definitive Kung kung fu movie where he's actually developed different camera techniques and different cameras, I think, actually, for this, but also side by side, which he has a lot of stars and a lot of directors talking about the demise of film. Well, demise. Mm-hmm. He's not really putting it that way. He's talking about the bridge between filmmaking and digital filmmaking, and where it's going and what's going to happen. And it's he's been lauded for this, and it's just huge. I mean, the cast list of people who are actually in the movie side by side. If you look it up, sidebysidethemovie.com, it's the science, the art, and impact of digital cinema. And there's just huge number of people involved in this. Lars von Trier.
Well, like David Lynch. I think he had a really interesting, surprising conversation with David Lynch.
Oh, David Lynch was amazing. And he always is amazing. I interviewed him a few years back in Paris, which sounds really glamorous, but you know, that's where he was. That's where he was. So that's where I went.
But what's interesting is people think, you know, film versus digital, you know, the purists, good versus bad, but it's not like that at all. It's surprising how many real auteur directors are embracing digital, and it makes them better at what they do.
Well, I think it's very funny because Lynch was saying, and I'm just looking through my notes here. It's so nice that the iPad's quiet. You don't hear me ruffling my papers. Where he was saying that he was one of the first directors to embrace digital. Everybody thought he was crazy. And he also made Inland Empire in Poland, and they gave him the keys to the city. It's so cute. And a Lifetime Achievement Award, and he's not even that old. But he was very, very, very keen about digital and what you can do with it and how fresh. He was saying the Japanese Blu-ray of Eraserhead is just amazing.
And liberating. Liberating.
Absolutely. To what degree does the film offer a verdict or a judgment on film versus digital, or is it just an exploration of both media?
Well, it is an exploration of both, and I think he's being quite optimistic about it because he knows that, you know, film isn't coming back. Of course, Keanu's not directing this; he's producing it. But it's a surprisingly detailed look. And if you are, for example, I was talking to one of London's prime projectionists, and he can run both digital projectors and 35mm, and very few people can run the 35mm now. And he was saying that, you know, people are really trying to hang on to this, but, you know, you can't stop it.
One of the topics, I think, is you know, for actors, what is the difference between acting for film and acting for digital? Was there a difference?
Well, I don't think there is.
But I was just wondering, in terms of the time it takes, like with film, everything took so long. So for actors to get into the mood, to do it over and over and over again, are there less takes in digital?
No, there are more. There are more because
digital's
endless. Yeah. You can keep shooting and keep shooting and keep shooting and keep shooting. You know, with film, you knew when you were going to stop. You know, you know, we only have so much film. We only have so many takes. Now with digital, you can have millions of takes.
Can we move on to some of the films that you wanted to talk to us about? The Life of Pi is a much anticipated adaptation of the Yann Martel novel, which I think everybody has a copy of in their houses. Some people have finished it, some people haven't. Gillian is a huge fan. I'm one of the people who got halfway through and then never quite got round to finishing it.
Right.
So this is it's Ang Lee who's done this film, isn't it?
Yes, actually.
Tell us more about it.
Well, this was premiered in Poland, and I actually didn't see it in Poland.
Right.
So that, but I was wanted to say it was the premiere, but we are actually, it's been screened a lot in London. I've been away, so I've missed it, but we're seeing it this week. From what I understand, the CGI is quite astonishing, and also it is not like the book. So don't, but then again, I've got very strong feelings about book to film.
So do I.
Because I think
there should
two
be two different things.
Thank you
Absolutely.
Very much. And I think it's ridiculous to read one thing or the other.
I mean, as a lover of the book, The Life of Pi, I just don't know whether I can step into the cinema. Because
well, you
it's
just
all in my head.
That
it's in my imagination.
So you have a different experience. Mm. It's like listening to a cover version of a song that you love.
Okay.
There
all
you
right.
go.
I'll go with
I'll
that
step
in mind.
Here. So I'm sorry I've disappointed you on The Life of Pi.
No, that's fine.
But bring me back next week. I'll have seen it.
Talk to us then about The Hunt.
I will. I'd love to. I would love to talk about that, which is Yagten. And it's Mads Mikkelsen, if you remember him from Casino Royale, the guy with the bleeding eye.
Yes.
He's actually an ex dancer. He's really quite amazing.
He has an astonishing face. He has a very haunted looking, gaunt face, which would arguably place him in the perfect position to play the role that he is doing in this play, in this film.
Oh no, absolutely, absolutely. And Thomas Vinterberg, he's an amazing filmmaker. I mean, in Festen, 1998, He was one of the Dogma people. And he kind of was wandering around a little bit with this one. But I loved when he was talking about casting Mads Mikkelsen for this, because he kind of wrote it for him, really. But he was saying, you know, here I've got the stallion of a man. And it's in this story about child abuse. Mm. And the influence is that we always trust children. We always think children are telling the truth. But a lot of times children don't understand what they're saying. And they may be saying it for different reasons. They don't understand the impact on adult life. And that's really what this is about.
This is a simple story of a teacher, a kindergarten teacher, who is accused of abusing a little girl.
Of abusing his best friend's daughter.
Who looks very angelic. She looks like the perfect angelic.
She is, but you get the impression that she's got a touch of autism or something. That she can't walk on anything that has lines in it. You know, like a tiled floor really throws her. And that's one of the reasons why they come together, because he understands that he finds her lost. And he says, what happened? And, you know, you can't step on the lines, can you? No. And so he takes her back. And her brother shows her some pornography in passing. And she feels neglected. And so she utters this thing that gets Mads Mikkelsen's character in trouble. But it's an amazing film because of the realism of it. It's beautifully portrayed. But also another thing is that you don't wonder whether he's guilty or not, which in a way I kind of like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not guilty, but this is what happens.
Let's have a listen.
Du skal ikke høre på, hvad de siger, Magnus.
Det er min bedste vens datter, det ved du godt, ikke?
Jeg tog på børnene, Lukas, det har jeg altid gjort.
Men for helvede, du har ikke gjort noget. Det er dem, der er blevet syge i hovedet.
That's a new Danish film called The Hunt, which is one of the choices of Karen Krasanovich, our film reviewer. It's not the first time that child abuse and allegations of child abuse have been brought to the screen. I'm thinking of Atonement, which is the adaptation of the Ian McEwan novel, done with varied degrees of success, some would argue. And then before that, a lot of the reviews have been saying that The Hunt is reminiscent of The Crucible, of a
witch hunt,
upstanding member of community who finds himself at the heart of a witch hunt.
Yeah, I think it's not only topical. I mean, it's always been topical. I mean, Festin, to a certain extent, also touched on this, but it's almost like identity theft or anything other, where something happens to you, you didn't do anything to bring it on, and yet your life is irrevocably changed. And I think that that's what's the frightening thing about it, that it could happen to any of us. And
things out of your control.
Absolutely out of your control. And you could. And the interesting thing about watching The Hunt, which universally everybody I've talked to has loved, which is unusual. Nobody's ever said, oh, you know, so, it's okay. You know, this is a really good film.
Loved, but uncomfortable. It must be an uncomfortable view.
It is, but Mikkelsen, I mean, this is where casting is so important. Mikkelsen is somebody that you want to believe in and want to be a hero, because he's a beautiful man, but he's also very kind. And I think that that's what makes this film exceptional. And I would urge everybody to see it, even if you don't like those kind of films.
Karen Krasanovich, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us here on The Review. It's Saturday in London. It's the day of the Monocle Christmas Market. And after this break, we'll be crossing to Nelly Gocheva for her weekly guide to some global cultural treats. Stay with us.
On Monocle's Culture Show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
You are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian DeBias, and Emma Nelson. Time now to cast our eye over what the world has to offer this weekend in terms of entertainment. And here is your guide, Nelly Gocheva.
This weekend in New York, the American Museum of Natural History is set to host the 36th annual Margaret Mead International Film Festival, featuring more than 2,000 films from around the world. We recommend Marcelo Machado's Tropicália, which looks at the culture of 1960s Brazil, featuring rare footage of Gilberto Gil in Caetano Veloso. For more information on the program, go to amnh.org. In Montreal, Galerie Simon Blais is showing a series of large-format contemporary paintings that challenge and deconstruct architectural forms. Curated by Paul Bradley and Catherine Pleasance, Liu Echafade brings together the work of young Canadian artists Lee Bridges, Jessica Peters, and landscape painting duo Dave and Jen, to name a few. The exhibit is on until the 22nd of December. This weekend marks the launch of the first Amsterdam Art Weekend, taking visitors on an exciting journey throughout the capital's contemporary art scene. Organized by the non-profit foundation, Capital A, three different routes take you through the 27 featured galleries, such as Gallery Oost, Janine Hofland Contemporary Art, and the independent art studio The Atelier, which will be screening films and videos by various local artists. For more information, go to capitala.nl. In London, the Fabricated Object exhibit deals with the notion of authenticity. Artists Angela de la Cruz, Mona Hatoum, and Gavin Turk, among others, explore the subject through various installations using shirt labels and aluminium sheds from around Britain. The exhibition is curated by Michael Petri and is based on his best-selling book, The Art of Not Making. The Fabricated Object is on until the 18th of January. And finally, in London again, there are a couple of markets happening this weekend. Make sure you stop by Midori House for Monaco's Christmas market. There will be plenty of food, drinks, music, and stalls to browse. And for the music lovers, the Old Spitalfields Market hosts the best and brightest of the UK independent record labels. Moshi Moshi, Rough Trade, Ninja Tune, and Sunday Best, among others, are showcasing new music and rare records as part of the independent label market. Many labels will be putting out special edition releases, including exclusives from Toy, The Strokes, Florence and the Machine, and Edwyn Collins. Let's hear English indie rockers Toy, With My Heart Skips a Beat. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
And that was Toy there and My Heart Skips a Beat, ending that look ahead from Nelly Gocheva. You're with The Review. Time now for our weekly music review. Today we head to New York to talk to this week's guests. No regular play DJs of note. Their sets include, among other elements, live trumpets and vocals. Their debut album, Endangered Species, was out this autumn, last week, I believe.
They're known as Greg Paulus and Nick De Bruin when they're not making records, and I'm delighted to say we're joined in studio by the duo. Hello, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
I wonder if first you can just explain, what is No Regular Play and how do the two of you work together?
Yeah, No Regular Play is a project that we started, I think, about 4 or 5 years ago when I moved out to New York after college. Greg was already there studying jazz trumpet, and we just started to get more into the electronic dance scene in New York, and we got a place together, and we thought, let's try making some music.
What was it that made you want to work together?
We've been friends since we were about 8 years old, I think, and it was something that I had never tried, music production, and Nick had never either, but we had a mutual
understanding. We grew up listening to almost all the same music. We used to drive around in the car listening to records and would go to the record store together. So we had kind of a very common musical thread.
So Nick, where was your first gig, your first set? Where did you play it and what was it like?
Our first set, it must have been in a, you know, some dive bar in Brooklyn, I think. Just DJing for nobody. We did that for a while. And then I think we got our own kind of residency at a bar, and that's kind of where we started practicing our live set.
Well, let's have a quick listen to what you are all about. There's a tune that's come out, and it's on your latest album called Won't Quit. We'll ask you to talk about it in a little moment, but sure. This is Won't Quit by No Regular Play. That was Won't Quit by No Regular Play. Our guest music review is here in the studio today on The Review. No Regular Play, otherwise known as Nick De Bruin and Greg Powless. Greg, tell us a little bit about Won't Quit, that track we've just heard.
That's a song that I think I started late one night when we were staying in Berlin, and just kind of developed a sort of the skeleton and the lyrics to the song. And then when we came back to New York for about a month and a half to basically, we did the whole album in a month and a half. We wanted to have it be a concentrated work period so everything would kind of gel together. And Nick came into the fold on that song and helped me kind of, we worked on the melody and the arrangements and added chords and kind of, developed it into a full.
You talk about Berlin, and I think what's interesting is DJs, you know, when they travel so much and what they do, and how do different cities affect you, inspire you, influence you?
I think New York inspires us a lot. It's definitely got, you know, there's so much to offer there, so much different culture. You can get outside of, you know, the dance world, which is what we're very part of when we're traveling around and playing in clubs. So I'd say New York is really kind of where we get the most inspiration, but just traveling in general is inspiring a lot of the time.
Yeah, we're very fortunate to get to see a lot of places that we definitely would not normally go. We were just in Brazil. That was amazing. We're going to Istanbul and Bucharest.
And so when you go there, do you really connect with like-minded people who are doing similar things? And which cities have you found really has a pulse when it comes to kind of new forms of music and playing music and presenting music?
I mean, London's always very forward-thinking. Berlin also, we have lots of friends in both those cities and really connect, and I think people understand what we're doing kind of the most out of everywhere we go.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. You can find like-minded people in such small, like in Tunisia, we found, you know, this a party there that had tons of people who were really into the music, and you just find all these little pockets all around the world of people who kind of like, they bond over this type of music. So that's always, you know, that's really special.
Let's move on to the next track that you've chosen by, is it by John Camp, All You Gotta Do? Tell us a little bit why you've chosen this piece of music for us.
This is another friend, actually, growing up in St. Paul, Minnesota. I've known him since we were five. Yeah. And he's another, you know, virtuosic jazz piano player who just moved out to New York and started working on house music. So
he's only been doing it for like 4 months now. Sorry,
makes you seize with envy, doesn't it? Let's have a listen.
Sure.
Camp there, and All You Gotta Do, the choice of Nick DeBruin, Greg Powerless, otherwise known as No Regular Play, two New York DJs who join us in the studio for today's review. A lovely little piece of music there, nice dreamy house, but the most amazingly soulful voice on top of it. Tell us how this voice came about.
Yeah, I think he was kind of, you know, he's probably been discovered by many people, but he was discovered by a friend of John Camp, whose actual name is Alex Sherber, on the New York City subway platform, just performing, you know.
Busking
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And how spontaneous does that say? What does that say about the spontaneity about the New York music scene? Can things just appear and just get together in that way?
Yeah, I mean, there's always really talented people playing in the streets or on the subway. I think that's a really cool. I mean, I've done it a bunch of times, you know, with like Jazz Trio or... We've actually thought about how it'd be fun to do
take our set down into the subway, and we need like a generator, maybe.
Yeah, maybe a generator, but yeah, I think.
Well, you don't just DJ, you know, thinking of DJing in the subway. You DJ at the Marcy Hotel. Now, explain to us a little bit more about what this is, because we were scratching our heads
we're
slightly.
We're trying to work out whether it's a real hotel what is it? Or a virtual
yeah,
hotel.
People,
help
us, gentlemen.
People
please.
Are always confused by that.
Yeah, it was like kind of a private. Like a label headquarters for Wolf and Lamb, and they would throw events there and kind of release parties and things like that for a while. But at some point, they had the idea to come up with a fake website for a hotel. So
it's a very convincing one.
It is.
It fooled me. I'm telling them, no, it's real. It's real.
Yeah.
The rooms boast toilet paper. It is one of those things that makes you think, okay, I smell a slight rat here. But it is. It's always borderline confusing. It's great fun.
We definitely multiple
so
times have no. We've seen like I'll. Come out of the house and there'll be like a couple of tourists with suitcases just looking up at the
and it's a really it's a run down a building, you know, 3-story apartment building.
What do you
building.
Say to them?
Yeah.
Is this a discreet apology? Would you like to come in and
yeah, sometimes
have a
people just
instead.
Walk in and you say like
yeah, sometimes
oh,
just open the door.
It's not actually a hotel, guys. Sorry.
No. It sounds like that you're trying. You keep everything as sort of neatly underground as you possibly can. Is there any temptation to do a massive crossover and go mainstream?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're open to anything. I think the underground element is kind of ingrained in us from the electronic house music standpoint, it's just kind of part of the culture. But we work with all different types of people and are always interested in, like, if it's a collaboration that seems right and natural, we're open to it, you know, whether it's mainstream thing or underground. I think it's more what, you know, how it feels.
And what gets you on a dance floor?
I don't know.
Well, talk a little bit. I love nice when I've bass, seen some of the visuals and the videos online of what you do. You mix sound and visuals, don't you? And I want to talk a little bit about the atmosphere you create with the visuals.
Well, there's usually most of the time there's a visual
component to it,
but it's not necessarily provided by us. It's more of a decision of the promoter. Hmm. Or the venue.
And that would be what, the visuals there?
A lot of times, it's like films or like recorded video segments that are played, you know, fast forward or slowed down or spliced with different things. I mean, that's something I would actually like to know a lot more about because I'm a bit clueless. Yeah.
Let's move on to another of your choices. I think it's your final choice for today. Slow Hands and Tana Ross, All the Same. Tell us, before we go to it and say goodbye to you first, tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, these are two guys, really good friends on the Wolf and Lamb label, and they just started collaborating more, and I think they made this one this summer in Mallorca, you know, just by themselves, all alone.
they really nailed it. I think everybody on the label is really excited about them working together on this. And we're actually playing with Tanner tonight.
Well, we wish you all the best with your new album. Nick De Bruyn and Greg Paulus, No Regular Play. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here in the studio for today's review. Let's hear their final choice, Slow Hands and Tanner Ross, and All the Same. And that was All the Same by Slow Hands and Tana Ross, the final choice of Nick De Bruyn and Greg Paulus, otherwise known as No Regular Play. And they are DJing in Shoreditch in London tonight on Saturday. That is Saturday, if you're in the area and you're interested. That was the New York outfit, No Regular Play. You're listening to The Review. Let's stay in New York now because it's time to take an in-depth look at one of our favourite cities to hear what's happening this weekend and in the coming days. Here's Barrett Austin from our New York Bureau to talk us through it.
Look at the calendar. It's December now, and that means the New York City Ballet is back performing Balanchine's Nutcracker. More than 90 dancers and 60 musicians are taking the stage at Lincoln Center for this year's performance. Tchaikovsky's classic score is sure to put you in the Christmas spirit. The Nutcracker is set to run through December 30th. Just a few days from now, the Metropolitan Museum of Art opens its latest show, a rigorous exploration of Matisse's painting technique, with 49 works on display. The show comes in the wake of recent exhibitions of Matisse's work in Paris and Copenhagen, but the early word suggests the Met show is top-notch. Matisse, In Search of True Painting, opens Tuesday, December 4th and runs through March 17th. On the film front, this weekend marks the New York premiere of Beware of Mr. Baker. Jay Bolger's documentary on legendary drummer Ginger Baker. A man who epitomized the ills of rock culture, but was downright regal on the trap set.
This film is about Ginger Baker, a man who stands for something in life that probably most of you do not.
Exclusively playing at Soho's Film Forum, this South by Southwest Grand Jury winner is set to run through December 11th.
Ginger Baker's a motherfucker. That's it. He personally is what drums are all about.
He's 35 nuts. He's mad.
Well, I think he was kind of fairly consistently horrible to people and to himself.
If they got a problem with me, come and see me and punch me on the nose.
And this evening, Nashville-based rockers Moon Taxi take to the stage at New York's legendary Bowery Ballroom. The five-piece Tennessee band mixes thoughtful lyrics with multi-dimensional sound, and despite the success of their most recent album, Cabaret, they prove their greatest talent when they're live on stage. Here's a sample of what's in store. This is Moon Taxi with Let's Go Back.
Everybody stares into the screen, but no one really cares what anything means.
For Monocle, in New York, I'm Barrett Austin.
Don't drink from the tears that leave.
Indeed, our men in your Barrett Austin. You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back after this to talk TV and hear about a baking phenomenon going global.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Welcome back to the studio. It's Saturday and you are listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Emma Nelson. And they've donned outside their best winter sweaters and their Canada Goose jackets for our Monocle Christmas fair. It's very frosty outside, but inside we're considerably cozier and we are now hunkering down for a spell in front of the TV.
Indeed we are. And our guide from Broadcast Magazine is Lisa Campbell. She joins us now in the studio. Welcome back, Lisa.
Hello.
You wanted to start with a series which is attempting to pretty much encompass everything that's ever happened on planet Earth, isn't it? It's the History Channel, now rebranded History.
That's right.
And this series called, what's it called? Mankind. Tell us more
about
it.
It's called Mankind, the Story of All of Us. And it is incredibly ambitious, as you've just outlined. If you like blockbuster movies, dramatic reconstructions and plenty of combat, you'll absolutely love this epic television series. It's just started airing on History all around the world. And you could perhaps sum it up as Die Hard meets Gladiator. So it's part of a new wave of big budget factual programming, and it's this kind of stuff is running on the likes of Discovery and Nat Geo, as well as History, and so they're all employing this similar strategy, which is really to produce a big global series that can be localized to try and avoid this kind of Euro pudding feel you get if you try to appeal to everybody. So in the UK example, we've got the cerebral comedian Stephen Fry doing this very weighty voiceover. You can barely recognize him. In the US, they're using Josh Brolin, and then all in different nations they will have a national star at the helm.
Well, let's have a quick listen to this.
We tame, we train, we trade, we gain. We sow, we reap, we write, we fight. We design, we build, we create. We strive, we thrive. And above all else, we survive.
My goodness, that was Stephen Fry giving his most mankindly voice I'd ever heard. It took me a little while to recognise that it was indeed Stephen Fry. He had to sort of take a run up at that, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, it's
do you
it's
think
like
it works?
Well, it's like the rest of the series. I mean, everything is huge. I mean, it's you know,
as in, the budgets must have
exactly.
Been.
Yeah. In 12 one-hour episodes, we sweep through ages, empires, inventions, and civilizations at warp speed, and the narrative is predominantly based around war. I mean, in fact, I was watching it. I thought if they say the word conquest one more time, it'd be impossible. But it is, it's very watchable. I mean, really no expense has been spared in the dramatic reconstructions and the CGI and huge numbers of extras. And, you know, I mean, the episode I saw was on empires and, it really proved Rome wasn't built in a day. It was built in seconds with CGI. I mean, you see aqueducts built brick by brick. And I mean, it's incredible.
I was reading something about the production values and maybe not as big a fan. It was talking about unmotivated zooms, staccato editing and jittering camera work. And then the sound effects are comically overwrought. Every infantry charge sounds like a buffalo stampede. Every yep. sword thrust evokes a butcher's knife being driven into a Casablanca melon.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think you will love it or hate it. I mean, it would definitely too over the top for some people. But I mean, it does, you know, it works in trying to be educational TV and entertaining. So I think it appeals to people who, you know, perhaps wouldn't pick up a book or wouldn't ever watch a history series. But there's enough for history buffs. I mean, there are some quite fascinating little facts here and there. It is headline history, I would say. There's, you know, but there's things like, you know, they used to collect the sweat of gladiators and sell it as an aphrodisiac. I mean, I don't know if you knew that, but you're not selling that here at the Christmas fair, are you?
No, but we do have a reindeer and Father Christmas. It made me wonder who this series is aimed at, because I looked at a few snippets of it and I thought, right, if I was a 10-year-old boy with a sword collection, I would absolutely love this. Yeah. This would bring history to life for me in a way that no history lesson in a classroom ever could do. But how gory or how... What's the level of intelligence expected by the viewer and the amount of work that the viewer is expected to do when they watch this?
Well, minimal work, really. I think this is the kind of, you know, you've had a busy day at work, you want to lie back on the sofa, you sort of want to feel like you're learning something, but you're really ultimately entertained. I mean, it's, you know, it's quite funny that they do the story of Paul on the run in Damascus, and it actually takes as long to watch him leaping over buildings parkour style and knocking over vegetables on the market stall as it does to talk about his role in the birth of Christianity. So it's kind of, you know, that level, really.
It sounds wonkily brilliant. Did you enjoy it when you watched it?
I did. I thought, oh, I'm going to hate this. You know, it was so over the top and sort of, you know, I thought this is going to be so irritating. But, you know, you are drawn in because it is such a spectacle, and there's enough to keep you there, to keep you interested. And the effects are so good, you know, and they show the kind of, you know, the silk trade and the kind of all the routes and going around the globe. And they make lots of the facts really relevant. So they'll say, you know, the equivalent that the empire spent on the military is twice the amount that America spends on the military now. So they're kind of trying to make it really relevant to you now. So I think that's quite clever.
So, not wishing to sound too much like a dry history teacher from the 1970s, have they got their facts right?
Yeah,
I
hope they have, yeah. I mean, I think they have lots of talking heads. They've got military experts, they've got professors. So it is interspersed with these people. So that definitely gives it an authoritative feel so that, you know, the history buffs, I do think, would sit there and think, yeah, I believe this.
But I suppose that's interesting with a lot of feature films. You have 3D and special effects all in fiction. But real stories are so riveting. They're often so much better than the plots of all the fiction. So then to give it the cinematic treatment is maybe quite interesting.
It is. And I mean, I do think it's, you know, it is quite male skewing because it's a lot more focused around, as I say, the combat than it is around, you know, trade and commerce and kind of, you know, and politics.
Diplomacy.
And those sorts of exactly, yeah. So it kind of feels like there was more going on in the world than sword fighting.
Let's move on to a subject which has been dominating lives for, well, since time began. Cooking, baking. Yeah. There's a programme that started in the United Kingdom called The Great British Bake Off, which had this parochial charm to it where you put basically normal people who loved making cakes and put them in a freezing cold marquee in the pouring rain for about 6 episodes, and they had to competitively make strudel. It was for many addictive viewing. Yeah. But one I had mistakenly thought would be something that was interesting
British.
Only to the British. I was very wrong there, wasn't I, Lisa?
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest, I was completely surprised as well. I mean, it turns out that it's actually one of the hottest properties that BBC Worldwide is currently selling around the world. So it has so far been sold over the past few months to France, Australia, Poland, Belgium, Ireland, Denmark and Sweden. Announced a few weeks ago that it was going to CBS in the States as well. It's taken Scandinavia by storm, and on TV4 it's attracting nearly a 30% market share. So that's the highest rating show ever on the channel. The Danish adaptation, it's the most successful of the new formats that's premiered this season on any of the channels. And I think, you know, it is interesting. I mean, cooking shows have been, you know, international hits for years, but they really sort of combine a celebrity chef with, you know, amazing cooking and probably travel as well. And what we have here is, as you say, a tent. And I mean, I think it's incredible that the British can sell baking to the French. I mean, that is just brilliant. But they have adapted it to be a little bit more upmarket. It's in an orangery. And, you know, and there is actually quite a lot of debate around it, you know, because it's the sort of, well, you know, the French market is more mature in culinary aspects. So we're going to be perfecting a croque en bouche, not making a Victoria sponge cake, you know.
Cultural differences as seen through cooking. Brilliant.
Right.
I think that in itself.
But this is what I found so interesting about the Great British Bake Off, that it would be divided into people who were the voyeurs of baking, those who consumed rather than made. And then there are the likes of, you know, many friends and family who would just sit there shouting at the television when some woman's queen of puddings was clearly not going to work as soon as she put it into the oven. And you knew that she was a fool for even attempting to do so.
Yeah.
Who are the audiences in the different countries? Because if you go to France, not everybody bakes. They all go and buy something from the pâtisserie. So there is still a huge amount of interest, but not necessarily the rolling up sleeves participation.
Well, I think it's so much more than a cooking show, isn't it? Mm. I mean, it's drama. I mean, who would imagine you're on the edge of your seat because you've gone onto this journey with passionate contestants that you just want to, you know, is that cream going to curdle? Is that bun going to rise? I mean, it's incredible that it can draw you in like that. Absolutely brilliant.
Let's have a little listen to this thrilling, thrilling programme.
This week...
My strudel's got a hemorrhage.
Seven bakers tuck into pudding.
I'm just prepping my klutz.
With a royal technical challenge...
Mine's not browning at all.
A showstopper that will stretch them to breaking point...
OK, I was worried for a second, I've calmed down now.
..and the hardest decision Mary and Paul have ever made.
It's tough.
I know.
These rain clouds are a sign of impending doom.
A clip of the Great British Bake Off there, not, you know, absolutely chock-a-block full of drama and excitement.
Yeah, and I think it's nostalgic as well. I mean, I just think it works on so many levels, and it's got a warmth, even though it's intensely competitive. It, you know, there's a lot of shows around at the moment in this competitive vein, and it's almost like bullying, and this is just the exact opposite of that.
But also you feel with shows like this, there's so many of them are really contrived, and you know, behind the scenes you can imagine the producers sort of orchestrating what everyone does and the disasters that are going to unfold. But this, I think, doesn't have quite that gimmickry. It's a little more authentic.
It is. I think definitely it's much more authentic. And I think it's also unexpected. I mean, it's not old ladies in their aprons. Mm. And, you know, the guy that won it in the UK was a law student. And it's really interesting that, you know, it's really attracting a younger audience to baking and sort of bringing baking skills to them and making it, you know, quite sexy in a way, really.
It is amazing what people are getting up to in their kitchens. Let's move very briefly on to The Killing, which we are big fans of here at Monocle 24. We interviewed the director a couple of weeks ago. You wanted to talk about The Killing, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, she's back. Hooray. You know, she's going to see us safely through the winter with her Scandinavian knitwear. I think there's been much anticipation for this third series, which I believe is the last. Boo.
Yeah, that's it. It's gone.
Yeah. Done. So, and I think, you know, there was some disappointment around the second series, actually. And, you know, and a hope that this would see it return to form. And I actually do think it's, you know, it's early days. We're only in the first few episodes. But I do think it's, we've got a real treat in store here. You know, politics remain at the heart of it. But this time the murder's being played out against a backdrop of a global financial crisis, a national election, a move of Denmark's national shipping company that will have major repercussions. But it's this combination of the personal and the political that I think works so well and makes it rise above the standard whodunit that's, you know, that everybody else seems to be obsessed with. So, you know, Sara Lund still has her personal problems, which are completely heartbreaking. The family, of course, is at the heart of, you know, affected by crime. So I just think it's intelligent. It's, you know, gripping and brilliantly performed.
Lisa Campbell, thank you very much indeed, as ever, for joining us in the studio. That's Lisa Campbell from Broadcast Magazine. I'm afraid that brings us to the end of Saturday's review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our thanks to our producer, Katie Bilboa, and our researcher, Fernanda Augusta Pacheco, and our studio manager, Ben Jay.
And if you are in London, do come and pop by our Monocle Christmas Market. There are tasty treats, hot mulled cider, beautiful gift stalls, and even Santa and real live reindeer. All the way from Finland. What could you wish for?
We're handing back over to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time with Robert Bound and Sophie Grove.
The review will be back same time next week. But for now, from me, Gillian DeBias.
And me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thank you for listening, and we're off for some raclette. Bye-bye.